Hi, this is Valley Voices for May 2019. I'm Mark Forsyth, broadcasting from the studios of CIVL Radio, 101.7 FM at the campus of the University of the Fraser Valley in Abbotsford. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that the land on which we gather is the traditional and unceded territory of the Stalo people. Every month, we explore Fraser Valley history, people, and stories. And today, we slide up the magnificent Fraser Canyon to Lytton to meet two women who operate two museums in that small community. Also, Ralph Drew was mayor of Belcarra for about 35 years. He's also a noted historian who has won the Lieutenant Governor's Medal for historical writing from the BC Historical Federation. And his newest book explores Coquitlam's story, a sweeping history from the glaciers through Indigenous occupation and the arrival of settlers via the river. But first of all, recently I drove the Fraser Canyon to Lytton. More people should do this. There is so much history crammed beneath the granite walls and beside the big muddy, the Fraser River. And did you know there are actually two museums at Lytton? Lytton Museum curator and archivist Marie Heaster is very proud of their archival photographic collection. We're going to meet her and also Lorna Fandrich, who's the owner of the new Lytton Chinese History Museum. Its collection of Chinese artifacts is second only to the Royal BC Museum.
Hi, my name's Marie Heaster. We moved from Burnaby in 1978. We've been here that long now that we're almost locals.
And how would you describe the story that you're telling through this museum?
We're hoping that we tell the story of Lytton being very important in BC's history. It was always a native gathering place. Then the
Because of the rivers converging
because,
here?
Because of the rivers and the wildlife for food and the plants that were available. Mm-hmm. When the explorers came through looking for the Pacific Ocean, they came through the Fraser Canyon, so they came to Lytton. And then, of course, somebody went and discovered gold, and that opened everything up. Then the railway came. That was part of being part of Canada, was to have the railway come through. And then the second railway came through in the early 1900s. So it's always been a provisioning point. Even once the gold rush in this area finished and moved up towards Barkerville, we were still a provisioning point. And at one time, we were even considered a possible capital of British Columbia.
Really? Who thought that might be a good idea?
There was a letter sent by the local people here saying that because we were closer to the rest of the province than Victoria, which was being considered, that we really should be the capital.
Fort Langley wanted to be the capital too, but Moody came along and moved them across the river to New Westminster. Mm-hmm. And when people visit here, what are some of the gems in this collection that you want to make sure people see?
We like to show them our photographs of the progression of the physical site of Lytton and the fact that there have been many fires that come through the town and have wiped out a good number of our heritage buildings. So our little museum is one of those heritage buildings that's still standing.
The fire is the scourge of many interior communities, I guess. Well, any community in BC.
Any community, but particularly bad here because we usually have a south wind, and once it gets started, it's not easy to stop it. It moves very quickly through the town. We have some interesting photographs of Main Street where there's one chimney standing and nothing else left.
What years would that be?
In the 30s, late 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. We're trying to bring in more local people and remind them that it's Lytton's museum. It's not my museum or your museum. It's Lytton's museum. And there are lots of photographs of the early days of the families. When they finished visiting here, they go to Lorna's museum. and she does her little spiel with them.
So I'm Larna Fandrich. I've been living in Lytton since 1978, and my husband and I own a river rafting company here. In the early 80s, we were operating out of downtown Lytton, and we needed an extra lot to park our rafts on because we were expanding. And so this lot that the museum is on was for sale. So we purchased it, and shortly after, a local gent came and saw us and said, did you know there used to be a Chinese temple on this site? And of course, we didn't know, and hardly anybody in town knew. And so he brought me an article written in 1934. But the temple was actually here from 1881 until 1928. Joss House can either be a temple or a community meeting hall or a place where they'd come for peace and solitude. So back to why I'm here. Mm-hmm. So in the 80s, I thought somebody should remember that the Chinese were here. And then when we purchased our resort lands out there, we didn't need this anymore. It just sat here for years. And I never thought it would be me that would do it. But then, because I thought someone would pick it up, do a little museum or something. And then a few years ago, when I knew I was getting close to retirement, I thought, why don't I just do it? So then it was a big debate. Do I form a society? And having been on a lot of committees in town, I went, no, I think I'll just go ahead and do it, and that way it'll get done much more quickly. And I am a sole proprietor, but what Bernie and I have decided that we run it 3 or 4 years, and if it's paying its own way, I'm fine with that, which it is already. It's paying its operating costs, obviously not paying for this new building. So I treat the building as an investment. So that's how I got into mm-hmm. it.
So the history of this place was speaking to you at the same time to actually decide to do this.
Yeah, and I have a bit of a background in trying to preserve history because my father formed the Spencer Historical Society in Alberta in Concert, where I was raised. Mm-hmm. And that's how we spent Sundays, six kids and mom and dad, going around finding all these sites for Indigenous. It was Blackfeet and Cree there, mm-hmm. and the first Northwest Mounted Police Station. So we went and researched, we went looking for things to actually find the site. So that's kind of my background from my father, I suppose. But in the end, I just wanted to do something so people recognize that Chinese people were here and also their contribution to this area, let alone BC. So my main goal is their contribution to this area.
But and you've received an award already. You opened what year?
I built in 2016, and I opened in 2017 and 2018. I operated 2 years now, and I've been very lucky to get recognition from quite a few Chinese sources, Chinese newspapers. Mm-hmm. I was used by Heritage BC as an example of museums and their economic impact on BC. I'm sure they chose me because I have no economic impact. They're choosing the little boys. And then, so recently Heritage BC now is giving me an award for outstanding in education and awareness on behalf of this museum. So I feel very fortunate for that too.
Well, congratulations. That's very exciting. You know you're on the right track.
One major concern I had all along is whether I'd be accepted by the Chinese community. Mm-hmm. Perhaps Lily Chow was... I met Lily after I was given the heritage designation for the Joss House site. I talked to her a lot about would this be acceptable with the Chinese community, that a non-Asian is actually doing this. But she agreed with what I think. It doesn't matter who's preserving these stories as long as they're preserved.
My thanks to Larna Fandrich, owner of the new Lytton Chinese History Museum. They're located on Main Street in Lytton, and their season begins this month in May right through until September. And also my thanks to Marie Heaster. Her museum is located on Fraser Street, the Lytton Museum and Archives, and more details on their season in July and August at LyttonMuseum.ca, and I hope you'll check out the upcoming edition of British Columbia History Magazine, where I put the spotlight on these two museums in Lytton, and what a powerhouse, those two working together. Thank you.
Would you like to get updates on your smartphone in an emergency, even if a cell phone tower is down? It is possible if the FM chip is activated on your phone. Learn more at freeradioonmyphone.ca.
Hi, my name is Mark Forsyth. This is Valley Voices, a presentation of the Langley Heritage Society. We are heard every month, right about this time, or you can listen to our podcast as well, on CIVL 101.7 FM from the campus of the University of the Fraser Valley in Abbotsford. Well, Ralph Drew was mayor of Belcarra for 35 years. He trained as a chemist, and eventually he became a local historian. His latest self-published book is called Coquitlam Chronicles, Historical Crossroads on the Fraser River, and I met with him at the Rec Center and Library in Surrey. We met midway to talk about his new book and his love of Fraser Valley history.
My name is Ralph Drew, and I'm a local historian, recovering politician. It was a number of years in municipal politics, but my passion in recent years has been local history. And Coquitlam Chronicles is my fourth book, and it was Mayor Richard Stewart who we were at a dinner one evening, an RCMP dinner, and he started to twist my arm, figuratively speaking, and said I should be writing a book on Coquitlam's early history, and he convinced me. So I got into it, and as I got into it, like with most of these projects, it quickly gains a life of its own and certainly captured me.
What was the story you wanted to tell? What was guiding you in exploring Coquitlam's history?
Well, Coquitlam, for a lot of the early history, is a bit of an orphan to what was happening in terms of the formation of the colony and the creation of New Westminster. The total focus and nucleus was New Westminster. And communities
like... Don't forget Fort Langley.
Fort Langley was there well before New Westminster, but as I started to look at it, I realized that the significance of Coquitlam was its location on the Fraser, its proximity to Burrard Inlet, its proximity to the Pitt River, and its proximity to New Westminster. And so it struck me that it was a crossroads. Certainly, going back to Fort Langley, the fur traders used Burrard Inlet as a means of bringing in trade goods and then would transport them across to the Fraser River. And when you look at the topography, it's a pretty flat and a pretty short run from the end of Burrard Inlet around the hill to Coquitlam River and down to the mouth of Coquitlam River. So that became a transport corridor. And then, of course, the river itself has always been the highway for Indigenous peoples and for many, many years for the settlers in British Columbia. Same for Pitt River. It opened up a huge area up into the interior where, well, it was really a question of resource harvesting, mostly logging.
Often the Indigenous story is glossed over in pioneer or settler accounts, but you spend a fair amount of time talking about how the landscape changed over time and how that affected the lives of Indigenous people.
I'm quite fascinated by that, the interrelationship over between the last glaciation period and today, how the landscape changed with changing sea levels. You know, it's easy for us to sit and think that things haven't changed very much, but sea levels have fluctuated up to 300 feet in that period. The glaciers suppress the land, just like you squeeze down a sponge. And so after the glaciers receded, the land slowly rose, which meant would start to reappear. So here you got the land moving, you got the sea levels moving, and you've got the Fraser River creating this huge delta. So the settlement patterns of the Indigenous peoples absolutely over time followed all of those changes. And I use as my example, the earliest archaeological site in the Lower Mainland is at Glenrose. It's in South Surrey, but it's right on the bluffs across from New Westminster. And today it's a long ways inland. 10,000 years ago, it was the shore of the ocean and the mouth of the Fraser River. We have another archaeological site, the Marpole Middens, which are about halfway along the north arm to the ocean. Same thing there. They're 5,000 years old. At that point in time, that would have been the mouth of the Fraser River. A mouth of a river is a very logical place to settle and to create communities. You have access to the ocean and all of their resources. You also have access to the river and all of their resources. So it's the perfect combination. But it's interesting to see how over time the changing landscape changed settlement patterns, and we're still seeing that today.
It's fascinating that that happened over 9,000-10,000 years, and some people would have moved on, others might have stayed. So there would be changes within those indigenous communities too.
Absolutely. There was a lot of interactions between the different indigenous groups, intermarrying for political reasons. Those sorts of alliances being formed, sometimes being broken in terms of warfare. Just like today, all of that goes on. When there's disasters anywhere in the world, there's always a residual population. Some will stay, some will move on to greener pastures.
You have training as a chemist, I believe. So is your science brain excited when it looks at this relationship between the landscape and how it's changed and people?
Very much. For me, there's two aspects. There's the research component, and there's a scientific discipline associated with that, particularly in terms of the documentation. Besides being very visual coffee table books, I pride myself on the fact that my books are fully referenced and fully indexed, and so they have their academic credentials as well. But the other exciting part for me is the jigsaw puzzle. You have an unknown, you want to answer, well, why did that happen? And, how did we get to this point? And you start to dig and find the pieces. And when the pieces finally come together and you say, aha, now I get it. That's why this happened. That's why this is at that location, etc. To me, that's really exciting.
You can't go two pages without seeing another image. So you really have packed a lot of images, whether it's photography, archival photographs, or paintings. You're fascinated by the paintings that were done by, as we move on now through the fur trade era and into the gold rush era, you feature many images from that time.
There's a whole category called documentary art, and the Royal BC Museum and Archives has an extensive collection. You have to remember that the 19th century, photography was a pretty specialized field. Not that many photographers, certainly not in the first half of the 19th century. The other problem, of course, photographs from the 19th century are black and white. And you can very easily envisage a black and white world, when in fact it has all the color of today. And so one thing about paintings and colored drawings, watercolors, etc., they reintroduce not only what the scene was in the 19th century, but it puts color to it. And that's what I find complements the traditional black and white documentary photographs.
We talked about how the river in Coquitlam area was a crossroads, but it is also a crossroads with our rail history, isn't it? When the CPR starts to come through the Fraser Valley and open up the valley and connect us with the rest of Canada, things begin to happen as well in Coquitlam. To take us through that,
I mentioned earlier that New Westminster was the focal point in the late 19th century, and when the railway was first laid out to terminate at the, well, it wasn't a city then, but at Broad Inlet at what is today Port Moody, the people of New Westminster felt quite left out. So in 1886, when the railway was finished as far as Port Moody, they also built a spur line from Westminster Junction, which was just on the west side of Coquitlam River, down into New Westminster so that they could be connected. That opened up the Fraser Valley in terms of rail to not only New Westminster, but 2 years later, late 1887, it opened up the city of Vancouver as well. Also in 1891, the Mission River Bridge was finally opened. That was hugely important for over 10 years. It was the only rail connection crossing the Fraser River to access the United States. So the people along the river in the Maple Ridge area, they now had the world opened up to them. They could go west to Vancouver, west to New Westminster, or south to Seattle and even on to San Francisco. So the railway absolutely transformed the world for people in the Fraser Valley on the north side of the river. And then it was very shortly thereafter that the Canadian National was built on the south side of the river, and it opened up on the south side of the river the communities in the same way.
And what's the genesis of Coquitlam as a pioneer settlement?
It really focuses around the Coquitlam River. The indigenous population, the Coquitlam tribe, they had settlements on the south of the Coquitlam River. But you have to remember that in 1860, when the colony formed, there were no roads. And so back to the rivers, and that was the only means of transportation. So the very first settler in Coquitlam was Alexander McLean, and he came by boat. He stopped just east of the Coquitlam River in a place called Pitt River Meadows, as opposed to Pitt Meadows on the east side. And he had his farm there. It's downtown Port Coquitlam today. And then within months, Stephen Hastings Atkins and his three sons, again in a home-built boat, sailed up the Coquitlam River to what was then an island, and they homesteaded there.
Irishman.
He was an Irishman. It's a very interesting story in its own right. He left Ireland in 1846 as a result of the potato famines. He was, I gather, part of the landed gentry. He had land, but when poverty hit Ireland as a result of the famines and potato plague, they were no longer receiving rents, couldn't keep up their own lands and paying taxes and things. So he, his wife and seven children emigrated to Australia. And his wife and two or three of his children stayed in Australia. And he and three of his sons came to the brand new colony of British Columbia in 1860 to try and make his fortune. At this point in time, he was 61 years old, and it was not an easy go. We have a huge number of Irish immigrants that came in many waves in Eastern Canada, but also into Western Canada, well before the Gold Rush, but there was another influx during the Gold Rush. And it was because of the hard times in Ireland, and they immigrated all over the world. Of course, we hear about the big Irish immigration waves to New York and whatnot, but it was true of all of the North American colonies.
Their biggest export, essentially, for many decades. Coquitlam also, over time, begins to establish a community, but it goes through something of a separation movement. There are parts of it that break away, like Port Coquitlam, and you're a former mayor, and you can probably put yourself in their place. Why would POCO decide, we don't want to be part of Coquitlam anymore?
The river was the focus, and that's where all the early industry was, the sawmills and the shipbuilding a lot of those activities. So you had Fraser Mills that developed into quite a healthy industrial base with a population growing around it in terms of not only their employee housing on the mill property, but Miardville immediately adjacent to it.
It was the biggest mill around, wasn't it, in its day?
By 1910, it was the largest sawmill in the world. It was quite huge, and they covered everything. Besides sawing logs, they did shakes and shingles and mill work for moldings and doors and whatnot. The railway came through in 1886, and so by the turn of the century, in the early 1900s, the CPR needed rail yards. Vancouver, with its constrained geographic base between the inlet and the river and False Creek, there wasn't the space for their rail yard. So they identified this large flat area in what is today Port Coquitlam, but that was all Coquitlam in that day. Mm. Coquitlam incorporated in 1891 and included everything except what is Port Moody today, but right down to New Westminster, right over to Pitt River. And so these rail yards meant all kinds of industrial development around them. This is 1911, 1912. There was land speculation going on like you wouldn't believe. It was boom.
Sounds familiar.
Yes. The cycle started a long, long time ago. But the boom times, people were speculating. The growth potential was seen to be unlimited. The decade from 1900 to 1913 saw unprecedented growth. The population of the city of Vancouver quadrupled in 10 years, from 25,000 to 100,000. That's a staggering amount of growth. Like I said, people were making big money, they were speculating in land, and so there was a whole group of people who felt Port Coquitlam was going to be an absolute bonanza because of the rail yards, and they, I can only speculate as to what they thought, but they thought, we should keep this for ourselves. So in 1913, they incorporated to take in everything east of the Coquitlam River and the rail yards right up to what's known today as Prairie Road. Oh, at the same time, Fraser Mills said, well, we don't want to be sitting here holding the bag for taxes to support the otherwise quite rural area of Coquitlam. So they too incorporated in 1913. Not to be outdone, the city of Coquitlam, or Port Moody incorporated, although that land wasn't part of Coquitlam. But the three of them incorporated at the same time. You know, it was going to be a golden era. No sooner had they incorporated than the economic recession of 1913 started.
And the war not far behind it.
And then 1 year later, the First World War. And those that event and the subsequent events, including the Depression and the Second World War, actually redefined the development of the Lower Mainland in many, many ways. Developments that were envisioned didn't happen. Things were put on hold. And so what might have been built wasn't. And when eventually it became to develop it, it was a different economic time and a different set of circumstances that guided the development.
In a way, it's kind of like the way the landscape changed. It affected communities. The way the world changed affected communities as well. And there's a lot more in the book, Coquitlam Chronicles, Historical Crossroads on the Fraser River. But just in wrapping up, Ralph, why is it important that we tell these stories now?
We have a lot of people, not just because they're young. I too was young once, and we don't pay attention that much attention to it. But there comes a time you need to understand where you came from to understand what's happening today and understand where we're going in the future, particularly when we have a large immigrant community that's coming from other parts of the world who have a different cultural understanding of how things develop. They don't know how it developed. They don't know the background and how it got here. And it's important that we preserve that information and say, this is where we came from, and it's on this foundation that we're moving forward.
Good to talk to you today. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for listening to me.
That's Ralph Drew, author of Coquitlam Chronicles, Historical Crossroads on the Fraser River. That's our show for this month. I'm Mark Forsythe. Thanks for listening in. Come and visit us at the Fort Langley CN Station, operated by the Langley Heritage Society. We're open in May on the Victoria Day weekend right through Thanksgiving. Coming up next, Rendezvous de la Francophonie at 1 p.m.